Thank you very much, Aaron. Thank you all for coming to this session. I guess I'd have to say that if Aaron thinks we're going to be like the Ramones, then we probably have to be up and down in 3 minutes flat. So in actuality, I'm going to treat this more as if we were the Grateful Dead and we may be up here for a little while. Before I begin, I do want to acknowledge my co-investigators on the work that I do, Richard Garfield and Erwin Redlener, plus the numerous people who have been a part of the study teams, several of whom are in the audience here. But we had 30 to 40 people teams for both our Louisiana and Mississippi studies, and it was really a team effort. And I acknowledge all of those folks who help really make this work, as well as Aaron and Prasharan, who are both completely instrumental in allowing us access into various places in Louisiana and Mississippi. When we talk about recovery, it's sort of a very challenging thing because there's no clear measure of what we're talking about that has recovered or when we know that that element has recovered. Federal disaster policy has long been focused principally on the recovery of place and not the recovery of person. So that if you think about a lot of the effort of the federal dollars that flow through and that come to the state to be reallocated, it's mostly in terms of trying to rebuild place and hoping that the place will allow people to come back and be socially and economically productive. But that doesn't necessarily say that the people who had lived there before have recovered. And I think that's a theme that may come up as we go through this panel. The images of Katrina initially people have seen, and I think that initial destruction is sort of burned in our psyche at this point. And when we think about this from sort of the all hazards response, we think about the spectrum of from the event to the response, and then the short and long term recovery are far harder to picture. The initial destruction is what is easy to picture and is easy to respond to. And it's what we sort of expect to see when we see a disaster. It's images like these. This is actually a picture of a health center that was completely gutted. And I know that the colleagues on the panel here have their own personal experiences with health facilities that were entirely destroyed. Here's a doctor's office. So in the wake of this enormous destruction, we're all now pretty familiar with the initial response to handle the displacement of a lot of the people, the million to million and a half that had to, well, a million that may have been displaced momentarily, but then several hundred thousand that were sort of permanently displaced. And one of the ways that people know was used was the trailer parks. The other thing that's often important to sort of think about is when I talk about recovery is what does it really look like from an individual's perspective? So this is nicely landscaped home the day before the hurricane hit, and this is it 2 days after the hurricane hit, and all you can see that's left is that glorious tree that was obviously stripped. And then this is what it looks like a year later. And it raises the question, you know, when is this sufficient recovery? And what is recovery from that individual's perspective? And what is recovery from the population's perspective who have been displaced? And how do we think about this? And how do we think about what policies and programs might work to help both the place and the people to recover? And there clearly are some promising signs. In terms of the depopulation of the trailer parks, they are being slowly phased out. And if anything, the pace has begun to pick up. So you could say, well, that's good news. And it is good news. And here you could see that beginning at the end of August, there was an acceleration of people out of the trailer parks in both Louisiana and Mississippi. And that's a good thing. The question then comes up, how is that process and transition being managed? Are there social workers that are helping people as they're being discharged from these trailer parks to help situate them back in the community, make sure that they have a place to live that is safe and stable, make sure that they have a good connection to the school system in the local area? Do they follow up with a connection to a medical home? This would be a good thing if they did. They don't. But it's sort of is a still a work in progress as this depopulation is going on. When we look at the kind of funds that have been spent, this is looking at Louisiana's monies spent. And you could see between the allocated and the spent that the monies allocated for the National Flood Insurance Program were 100% spent because they were allocated on a claims basis. So that worked well. And 92% of the disaster relief monies were spent, which is also good. It paid for that initial response and the initial infrastructure recovery that had to take place. But the troubling number to look at is 26% of the monies that have been allocated for rebuilding have been spent, meaning three-quarters of the money have not been spent. And this is current as of 2 to 3 weeks ago. So when we look at some of these population indicators, you could see some good news and bad news. You could see of the 450,000 that had been living in New Orleans, there's been a return of, well, it's a debatable question, but maybe 260, 270, 280,000 people back into the area. But with that, there has been, as everybody has heard, some serious consequences. The murder rate increased by 69% from 2004 to 2006. The public school enrollment fell dramatically, and then the rents, as you can see, increased enormously. Right after Katrina, they went up 50%. So amongst those people that are renters, they find it virtually impossible if they were on either fixed incomes or looking to live in affordable housing to find comparable housing to come back to. So this is all part of the good news, bad news. The good news is that some indicators demonstrate that the gross domestic product for New Orleans is at around 80% of what it was before Katrina, and the population is only at about 67%. So if you do the math, you could say that's a great improvement. They are more productive now than they were before Katrina. It's essentially a denominator problem. It's people who had been in that denominator who are no longer counted, who no longer live in the New Orleans area. They are still displaced. There has been a lot written in the literature about what are the effects of a disaster, both short and long term, in terms of the mental health consequences. And for those who are interested in this, I would actually point you towards this article. There are a pair of articles by Fran Norris called 60,000 Disaster Victims Speak, which is sort of a review of many, many cohort studies over a 20 to 25 year period. And among the things that she looked at, finding these, replicated findings across many different cohort studies, were the effects, the trauma and stress, and the contributing factors, a severe exposure, living in a blighted community, high secondary stress. Okay. Down. The survivor characteristics that are associated with poor mental health outcomes. Whoops, let's go back. Are being female, being middle-aged, poor, minority status, prior psychotic or psychiatric history. The family context, if there were kids in the home, if you're female in the presence of a spouse, you did worse. So, I like to say, well, for me, that's a good thing. For guys, we actually do better if we have a spouse present. She often does worse because the women often feel that they have to maintain the household as well. So the strain on women is far greater, particularly in the presence of those kind of household issues. But it's the last thing that I really wanted to momentarily focus on, which is the resources available to people. And this is something that has been found again and again in many studies. When people lack or lose their belief in their ability to cope, when they feel that they cannot control the outcomes, and when they have few social resources, that's when they are particularly vulnerable and find it most difficult to recover. Another way of looking at this has been advanced in the sort of international literature, and they look at these psychosocial aspects and they say, you have your network, your social network has been disrupted. The systems of security and justice systems are now unreliable. This is from war-torn areas and conflict areas, as well as those areas that have been exposed to catastrophic disasters. There's a sense of social disengagement and a loss of social identity. And by this, if you had been somebody who worked somewhere beforehand and you lost your job, but your identity was as a worker. I was a nurse, I was a teacher, I was whatever I was, a public health worker, but you no longer have that as your identity, that has a serious consequence for you. And loss of meaning in your life. And for this, there are a couple of Australian psychiatrists who have really framed this socio-ecological framework of these kind of aspects of disaster. So what we've done in the Gulf Coast Child and Family Health Study is try to look at what some of these issues are in the Gulf Coast by building up a longitudinal cohort of 1,247 households that were impacted or displaced by the hurricane. And our objectives initially were to address the immediate needs assessment, but then to begin to look at what are the factors involved in recovery over time. So when we started to build our sample, we had a Louisiana sample first and the Mississippi sample second. And we looked at the people who ended up in the state in congregate settings that FEMA had subsidized, meaning FEMA trailer parks, private trailer parks, and the hotels. And we were there at 6 months after the hurricane. And when we went to Mississippi, we added one other element, which was we looked at people who lived in those communities along the coast that were hardest hit. So we ended up going down and randomly sampling from the census blocks that were amongst the hardest hit census blocks and going and recruiting people into the sample. The Louisiana cohort was recruited at 6 months, Mississippi at 12 months. We've just conducted a follow-up survey that happened at around a 22-month period. This is built on a stratified multi-stage cluster random sampling. And all told, it probably represents anywhere between 60 and 80,000 individuals. That would be the universe of people that we are describing who were displaced or really heavily impacted. The kinds of things that we looked at, housing and health status, access and use of health services, their attitudes and behaviors, but then really this more fundamental question of have you recovered and where are you in terms of your relationship to your social ties, your social network, and how you feel about yourself. When we looked at just the trailer park evacuees alone, we had a number of them. Obviously, that was one of the core elements of our cohort at both the 6 to 12 month recruitment phase. When we went back at 22 months, we found that a third of the people that we had initially talked to had moved back into the community. That was a good thing. And two-thirds were still in the trailer park. But of the third that were in the community, one-third of them were living in trailers in front of their house. And if you can imagine what it's like to be living in a 250 to 400 square foot trailer with a family of three, four, or five for a period of years, you can begin to imagine what that the implication is for the social harmony or disharmony that happens in a household. It's an incredibly stressful experience. And in terms of the population data, at its height, there were 22,000 trailers in the group trailer settings, and as of a few weeks ago, there were still 13,000 of them living in these group trailer settings in FEMA trailer parks. In terms of the private trailers put on people's yards, there were 109,000 trailers at the height. Now they're down to 49,000. So we began to look at, well, what was the difference between the people who moved out of the trailer parks and back to the community and those who still were remaining in those trailer parks at 22 months? And there are some really stark differences. The LA means Louisiana, the MS means Mississippi. So you could see that the comparison is the people that are in the trailer parks who stayed far less likely to be in a partnership relationship, far less likely to be earning over $10,000 a year. They're very poor. They're far less likely to have at least one employed adult in the household, and they're far less likely to have been a homeowner. In other words, there's a sorting out process that is really going on. Those people who have the resources to move back into the community are taking that opportunity to move back. Those that don't have those opportunities are left further and further behind, and they are going to have to deal with they're no longer all together in one city where they might have been before, and they at least would have been reachable. Now they're sort of dispersed, so it's harder to put a spotlight on the kind of issues that they may be facing. When we look at the children's chronic diseases, just to give you a quick look at this, the green bars, the top and the bottom, represent how the cohort that we talk to looks like compared to the National Survey of Child Health that was done in 2002-2003. So that sort of is a pre-Katrina comparable survey or population in Louisiana and Mississippi. And what you could see is that our cohort pretty much looked like, the green bars are pretty much the same pre and post. There isn't that much difference in terms of chronic disease. But when you look at the impact after, 22 months after, what you see is an enormous tripling, quadrupling, and quintupling of the depression or anxiety, and these are clinically diagnosed conditions, or the behavioral or conduct. Whereas something like diabetes, there is no, you know, huge expansion in the chronic disease incidence amongst these populations. We're beginning to see asthma increase, although this could be with greater access to care, it's beginning to be diagnosed. It could also be related to the formaldehyde in the trailers or mold. It sort of is an open question. When we look at the medical home status of kids, we see that in some ways there are some good news indicators here. When you look at Louisiana, you see that a large number of people under the gained medical home were able to, as a result of the disaster, gain a medical home, a place where they are now attached to a provider and a group of specialty and ancillary services and have continuity of care. So now in Louisiana, it's a fairly substantial number, much less so in Mississippi, but then again in Mississippi, they were more likely to have had a medical home beforehand. But when you look at the numbers of those who lost medical homes, that's kind of stable. It's around 20% across all of these populations who had one before the hurricane, who no longer do. When you look at the uninsured, again, there's some good news, bad news. In some ways, the startling number to me is the number of Louisiana uninsured, which is, in the trailers, 12.6%, in the community, 8%. This is far less than the pre-disaster statewide levels, which were hovering at around the 20% level. So this could represent a beginning of a push into some insurance markets, particularly into the Medicaid or SCHIP markets for these kids. Mississippi didn't do so well. They are less likely to have gotten into those markets, and they're more likely to be uninsured. When we ask the parents, do any of your kids have emotional or behavioral problems that they did not have before the hurricane? This is now 22 months out. There are so many of them that say, yes, my children, at least one child in the household, close to 3/4 across all of these, or at least 70% have said, yes, my child has some emotional or behavioral issue. And when we asked them to list them, they were sad or depressed, nervous or afraid, problems sleeping or problems getting along with others. And it's not like these have gone away. A good 2/3 approximately are still experiencing these problems, even 22 months out from the disaster. When you look at what kind of financial resources some of the people in our study have, those who were displaced or greatly impacted, you see that they're really living hand to mouth. They don't have, they're living in a cash economy. There's no wiggle room here. A good portion of them don't have checking or savings accounts, particularly if they lived in the trailer parks. Very few of them in the trailer parks had access to credit cards. When we used a conventional mental health scale, we administered something called the Short Form 12, which is part of the medical outcome study set of measures of mental health disability and distress. We found out that the caregivers were experiencing incredibly high levels of distress. About 2/3 of the caregivers were at levels of either extreme or near extreme levels of mental health distress. The darker dots were at the earlier baseline, and the red dots represent at our 22 months. So there's some improvement, but it hasn't improved above that blue line into the gray where they would actually be, you know, in the what might be considered the healthy area. And just as a comparison, for years we've done studies on HIV/AIDS cohorts in New York City, and we would ordinarily see the kind of levels of this mental health distress amongst 30 or 40% of our population. And this was, you know, a drug-using, homeless population. And here amongst these caregivers, we were seeing 60 and 70% distress. So the levels were incredibly high, and they have not gone down that much. When we look at issues of safety and security, we ask the parents, do you think that there are people in your neighborhood who were a bad influence or could be a bad influence on your children? And here you could see that those who said yes, there are people in their neighborhood who could be a bad influence, the yellow bar represents those who live in the trailers now, the blue are those who live in the community now, the red underneath represents that pre-Katrina data from the National Survey of Child Health, and we restricted it to those that had federal poverty line below 300% to try and give some comparable sense. And what you could see is that those in the trailer parks really are expressing a great deal of uncertainty about the safety or security, a little less so in the communities, which is good. Then we ask people, do you feel that your children are never or only sometimes safe? And here you see an interesting thing change, which is now in the communities, it's not so much that they say they feel that there are people with a bad influence, but in the communities they're feeling that their kids are not really safe. So there are these issues of how are the systems of security and the criminal justice systems, are they working sufficiently to give people a sense of safety and security? And clearly it's nearly threefold what it was before Katrina. We ask people if you feel that your children are never or only sometimes safe in the schools. And again, it's the communities are even more likely to say no, they don't feel. Two-thirds in both Louisiana and Mississippi are saying they don't feel that their kids are safe in the schools. And then we ask people whether they were afraid to walk alone in their night at night in their neighborhood. And we see that essentially over half are afraid to walk alone at night in their neighborhood, whether it's in the community or in the trailer parks. When we asked about academic performance, we said, we want you to rate your kid on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being very poor, 10 being the best, and tell us, how is your child doing in school academically? And we asked them pre and post, you know, how are they doing before the hurricane, and how are they doing now? And so what you could see in the community, there was a drop in both Louisiana and Mississippi. And these are statistically significant drops in how parents perceive their kids are doing in school. Similarly, there was a drop, a little less so in Mississippi in the trailer parks, but certainly in Louisiana, there was a drop in how parents perceive the kids were doing. And then we asked everybody, how would you characterize your sense of recovery now where you are? Would you say that your situation is better, back to where it was, worse than it was before the hurricane, or you're unsure because things are still changing? And I have to say, when we asked this question, I was actually expecting to see that maybe 70 to 80% were going to tell us that things were worse than they were before the hurricane. And I was a little surprised by some of the findings. So amongst those who said better, people who are now living in the community in Louisiana, 20% are actually said things are better than they were beforehand. Although everywhere else, it's only 7, 8, 9% saying it was better. Back to where it was? Not many people said it was back to where it was. Worse than before? Somewhere between 30 and 40%, it was worse than before. And then the surprise to us was how many people said they are still unsure. And what it sort of, the little light bulb went off for us is that there's a term called ambient uncertainty. And that's sort of a sociological term of this notion that when you're trying to negotiate your relationship with various people in your community and your social spheres, how certain are you about what the stability is of your social surroundings? When you're greatly uncertain about everything about your life, where you're going to be, how you're going to put food on the table, where you're going to be living, how your kids are doing in school, this is leading to this kind of sense of ambient uncertainty. So if we think about this notion of post-disaster recovery, we think about all the different elements that have to be engaged and involved to really have a recovery of person and of place. You need the infrastructure, the community, economic recovery, social re-engagement and personal recovery and resiliency. And it operates at all these levels, but they're all overlapping in some ways, so that when you can do the infrastructure redevelopment, yes, you can build up the place, but then you have to build up the households there by really putting in sufficient amounts of money and the right money to bring back the housing that would be useful to people. And at the same time, at the individual and family levels, you have to have some mechanism to allow people to engage again with those institutions in their lives. Number one, it can't only be an entitlement program where you just give people and you create and foster a new dependency. There has to be a sense of how people, you have to give people the opportunity to rebuild that community for themselves as well. You have to give that helping hand so that all told, they can really engender the sense of self-efficacy and resilience. Thank you.